Mr. Horatio Realto.
Yes, we'd heard that, as I said, the submarine was sailing at dawn, and Humphrey then launched, armed up, with live depth charges to search for the submarine. I believe the hope was we might catch on the surface, but the OS-63 is an anti-submarine helicopter, had a dipping sonar which should be capable of searching and finding. Fortunately for us, probably unfortunately for the Argentinians, they actually caught the submarine on the surface. And again, fairly well documented, the an attack commenced. Humphrey made two passes with depth charges, dropping one on each occasion. And I was told by the second pilot that the first one landed right beside the submarine and exploded. And the second one, they actually bounced off the casing and rolled around the side and also exploded. It was a fairly historic event, really, because that's the first time a submarine had ever been attacked by a helicopter. Although for years we've been practicing using our helicopters in the anti-submarine warfare role, that's the first time this had actually taken place. Meanwhile, obviously, an engagement signal had come back from the aircraft to the ship. Though we didn't see this, the other aircraft then got airborne. The Lynx got airborne with torpedoes, and I believe the Wasp got airborne. That was armed up with missiles to try to further prosecute the attack. Meanwhile, Antrim now went up to full power to close to the area, because obviously the aircraft had flown away and found the submarine at a fair bit of range. I don't know the distance. And that was one of the most amazing sights I've ever seen. It wasn't a calm sea, it was fairly rough, probably about a 4-6, something like that, with the ship going absolutely full power straight into it. And we were actually getting wet on the flight deck from the spray coming over the ship from the bows. And at the same time, there was two massive bat lanterns up on the masthead. And the strangest thing I've ever seen, to me, I thought the sea was red. And I subsequently found out it was actually krill. One of the great riches of the Southern Oceans is krill, which the whales feed on, and it gives the sea a reddish bloom. And this was most eerie. At the first light, there's your sea red, and battle ensigns up charging into battle. In fact, Humphrey then arrived back on the flight deck for some more depth charges. We rearmed it, and it was launched again. She was held for a little while the other attacks were being prosecuted, and then Humphrey was told to go again. But in fact, at that time, the submarine had turned around and gone back into harbour. She was actually damaged by the depth charges. I know that the Wasp of Plymouth also fired two of the AS-12 missiles at her and knocked holes into the conning tower as such, which was enough for the captain, and he went back into Gritviken. And the decision was then taken. We then were steaming up and down outside. The immediate submarine threat was gone. And then my captain, Captain Young, who was actually the commander of the task group, I believe with his military aides, the soldiers, the brigadier, they then took the decision we were going to make a landing to retake South Georgia. They decided, I think, that we'd rock them back on their heels for peace and we might as well press home the advantage. And we then, HMS Plymouth and the Antrim, both ships equipped with 4.5 guns. And we then started a bombardment. We were steaming up off the coast and bombarding ashore. The landing zone had been picked previously, that this is where they were going to attempt to land, which was actually a marshy ground out on the edge of Cumberland Bay, just down from Gritviken. And we commenced the bombardment. It was quite amazing because we were firing over a mountain into this area. The Wasp off the Plymouth put ashore a naval gunfire support team, which is an army specialist group. They put them on a hillside overlooking the bay, and then by radio they were controlling the gunfire. And the master gunner, Mr. Barraclough, Lieutenant Barraclough, was the of the Antrim, amazingly skilled man. His gunnery was absolutely spot on. They put the shells exactly where they wanted them. They would put in one round or two rounds to sight, measure the fall of shot, and then so many for effect. And the barrage, we then, using the two Lynx and Humphrey, we landed the troops in relays. We flew them ashore, and all from the Antrim's deck. I mean, I was then on deck with the SDO. We were busily sorting the troops into sticks, getting them into the aircraft as each aircraft pitched up, and we put in, I think it was about 180 troops. Once they were landed, the bombardment was raised ahead of them. So as they advanced towards Grytviken, the bombardment was just ahead of them. And afterwards, speaking to them, some of the troops said the gunnery was fantastic because the rounds were landing 100 yards in front of them. And then they were sort of moving down into that area, and then the barrage was raised, advancing all the time. And at that point, I go a bit foggy on some of the events that led to it, but I do remember then the Antrim steamed into Cumberland Bay, which is a vast bay, and Grytviken was kind of round the corner to the right as you went in to the bay. Grytviken was hidden round the corner. It's an old whaling station, and that's where the Argentinians were. And most people were either now within the ship or on the weapons station. Well, for a flight, our action station is the flight deck or the hangar. And I remember most of the flight at this time, the aircraft was back on the ship, and the flight were in the hangar, and I went out onto the deck to see what was going on as we steamed into the bay. And I had a telescope, and I was, as we came round, for the first time, this was the first time we'd ever seen Grytviken, because it was all around the corner from us. And as I looked in, I picked up, and I focused on the with the telescope I had, and I picked up the buildings, and then I picked up the flag mast, and it had an Argentinian flag on it. And as I looked, I saw a white flag go up, and that was the Argentinians had decided to surrender. And in fact, it was a bloodless coup, because they saw the troops advancing, saw the barrage advancing, and then they decided, we don't want any of this, so they surrendered that position. Humphrey was then launched shortly after that to go to take in people to obviously negotiate the condition of the surrender. I think that was fairly precarious, because the flight commander went over the area, and there was a cleared ground area, but what they were uncertain of whether it would be mined or not. In fact, they landed, and then all the subsequent events took place, and the surrender was completed. The main group of Argentinian specialist troops actually round in the next bay, a place called Leith. And that's where they had their special troops, and they were probably the real fighting troops. We'd probably hit the lesser fighting troops the first time, which was probably just as well. And I believe in the whole event, there was only one man lost his life, and that was a man on the submarine. I mean, it was our shipwright's job then. They constructed a coffin, and then we buried him in the cemetery at Grytviken, where Shackleton's buried, actually. That's where Shackleton's grave is there. The man was then laid to rest there with full military honours. We then left our... We landed then the troop M Company, I think they were called, which was a Royal Marine detachment, to garrison the South Georgia. The prisoners of war were taken and put into Tidespring, and I think the hangar, because it now didn't have any aircraft, was used as sort of as their quarters. And then, with us in company, we steamed north to go back towards Ascension, taking the prisoners of war back to Ascension. And we thought, oh, that's nice, you know, perhaps that's it. But unfortunately, it wasn't to be. We thought we would make Ascension, but in fact, we were about halfway back up, back about the Roaring Forties area, when HMS Antelope rendezvoused with us, with the group, took off a couple of the more sensitive prisoners we actually had on the Antrim, and took over escort of the Tidespring and took her to Ascension. We were then turned back to head south again. And the Antrim then went across, and we rendezvoused mid-Atlantic with the group of LSLs, the landing support ships, Galahad, Tristan, that bunch. And we then escorted them back down to join the main battle group. By this time, the main battle group was assembling off the Falkland Islands, because no political resolution, and suddenly it was going to be for real. Passage of time. It's there was a lot of to-ing and fro-ing of troops, and obviously decisions going on, and assembly, and the plans were being formed, and all the other things, which is, we're not informed of that. And we just, our task is to keep the air as as the flight was to keep the aircraft flying. That's exactly what we did. And then, I mean, one or two things on the aircraft, we had some fairly severe, not severe, damaged pieces, which I had to, with a lot of improvisation, repair, which we did. And then just, well, we didn't know at the time, but then suddenly the aircraft landed on one day. Guys come in and said to me, I think we've got a major problem here. I went out and found the engine had finally shed its, only had a single engine, had shed its oil, front oil seal, and blown all the oil out. I mean, luckily it got back on the deck and the whole cab was, aircraft, was covered in oil. Shut the engine down and the remains of the oil ran out the engine intake, and then that was it, that engine was finished. We now had an engine change on our hands, which I could have done without, on a Wessex 37 and on a guided missile destroyer, because of the configuration of the ship and the aircraft. That's a particularly difficult and cramped event, and also a very lengthy event on the Wessex 3. Anyway, had to be done. And the flight commander come down and said, yeah, this engine has got to be changed, and like quick. Because this time there's lots of cross-decking going on, troops movements between ships, getting the right troops in the right ships in the right orders and all the other events. We now had a major task on hand, the maintainers of the aircraft, we had to change the engine. And so we set to, there's only, everyone is traded. I mean, the mechanical trade looks after the airframe and the engines, and you have electricians who look after the electrics of the aircraft, and radar, radio men who look after radio, radar and sonar. Obviously the mechanical men, which I'm one, that was our task now, we had the engine to change.
How long does that normally take?
Well, having changed it and set it up, and then you have to tune the engine to the aircraft, it can take, back here at Portland, sometimes it would take 3 or 4 days to do it. Well, we didn't kind of have that sort of time. I knew we were up against it, got the boys together, said, look, it's got to be done, and we didn't stop until it's finished. And we actually worked for 48 hours without stopping. We were just fed at the aircraft. The rest of the other trade people sort of kept us fed with coffee and did all the running around for us while we were doing the actual job. Because when you're changing engine, it's not just take an engine out and put it in. There's lots of stuff needs to be done in the aircraft to prepare for the replacement engine and checks to be made and whatever. So, I mean, after about 36 hours, we'd actually done the physical nuts and bolts. The old engine was out, the new one was in, all the ducts, trunkings, connections, everything had done, the aircraft was rigged. We then had to get it onto the flight deck, and you have to tie the aircraft to the deck, a special frame to tie it to the deck so it won't take off. And then you have to run the aircraft up to full power, do a lot of adjustments on the engine with the engine running. I mean, at this time we were exceedingly fatigued, to say the least, and we weren't probably seeing too well at the time. I mean, we had one particular incident. We were trying to put oil into the engine because I was bleeding oil out. And we thought we couldn't get oil in. And in fact, the oil tank was completely full. And just, probably just pure fatigue of looking at this thing, we just couldn't see in the sight glass the fact that we'd gone off the top of the glass and it was full. Because we'd been so used to looking at used dirty oil in the glass, we were now putting clean new oil in. Until one of the other guys came out, and we shut the aircraft down, in fact, and said, we've got a bit of a problem. And he looked in, said, we can't get oil into the tank. And we couldn't work out why. And he was a bit fresher because he had some sleep. He came out and said, not surprised, it's full. So, oh, okay, pretty silly. We'll start again. So we did. Anyway, we finally got it all set up. And then finally we got to bed for the first time for 2 days. And I think I had about 4 or 5 hours sleep, and we were up again, and we were told now we're going in. This is the Falkland landings are taking place. And Antrim then led the group in. We went in the middle of the night. Didn't say before, we stayed on GMT. The battle group stayed on GMT all the time. So local time, we were steaming in for a landing at dawn, GMT. But in fact, local time, it was about 2-3 o'clock in the morning. So it was the middle of the night. So for the people on the ground, this was the middle of the night we suddenly arrived. Whereas for us, it was just dawn. And that is a kind of a psychological thing. The middle of the night is a very bad time for everybody, for human beings. Whereas dawn, you're starting to come awake. And I'm sure that's why it was done. And it did throw people off balance a piece. Anyway, we steamed in. We remained in Falkland Sound. It was really eerie because it was in total darkness. And I then had, well, the unique experience. We had three aircraft on the Antrim, three Wessex aircraft on the Antrim, designed to take one. I had Humphrey, which is our own aircraft, is up outside the hangar, which is up beside the superstructure. And we had two Wessex 5 aircraft, which we managed to get one up on the starboard waist of the aircraft. That's the other starboard waist of the ship. That's the other side from the hangar, and one standing on the flight deck. And in the middle of the night, in total darkness, because the ships were in total darkness, there was no lights whatsoever being shown, we had to actually get these aircraft onto the deck, spread the rotors, and get them launched, which we achieved with some trepidation and difficulty. And they, in fact, then put in naval gunfire support teams in the dark with some special equipment in the aircraft to help them in. And then the Antrim then commenced the bombardment again, and we actually bombarded Fanning Head all night. And the main ships were steaming past underneath. There was an Argentinian garrison on the headland. And again, with the aid of the people spotting ashore, they were actually called down a most effective gunfire, most effective barrage. I've forgotten the numbers. It was something like 380-odd rounds we put ashore that night. And it took out the garrison on the headland. A lot were damaged. It was quite an amazing sight to see, because all you could see was flashes in the dark. And you obviously, when the gun fires on the front of the ship, the whole ship shakes. And then every now and then we see the fall of shot ashore, and then I saw an ammunition dump go up and a fuel dump go up, because they'd been hit. The gunfire had been called onto them and destroyed them. And then we never saw any more, because then it was dawn. And we were now out in Falkland Sound with about five ships, and I can't remember all the names now. But there was the Ardent, ourselves, Antrim, brilliant. Plymouth, no, Yarmouth, I think it was Yarmouth, not Plymouth. And one other, Argonaut. And we were now on the infamous gun line. Not that we realised that at the time, or the implications at the time. And dawn came, and it was the most beautiful day we didn't want. Bright blue sky, lovely sunshine, almost calm sea, blue sea. It was really very beautiful. And then, of course, the aircraft attack started. There was submarine cover being provided by the Sea Kings at the entrance to Falkland Sound. That was in case any submarines were going to try and sneak in and get among us. And Humphrey should have been joining them. And this is one of the times when we had a problem. We had a problem with some of the electrics on the aircraft, and Terry was the electrician. He was actually working on the aircraft, which wasn't on our flight deck. It was just up the side of the flight deck, outside the hangar door.
We should say this is Terry Bullingham.
Terry Bullingham, yeah. The first thing we, if apart from the fact we'd been bombarding, the first kind of retaliation we actually saw was then, I don't remember the time, but sort of mid-morning-ish, suddenly there was aircraft among us, and I remember, which was a Picara, and that was just skipping across on the land. I saw it just roll over and climb over a low headland and disappear. I thought, blimey, that was moving quick. And that was it. And then suddenly there was aircraft upon us, and they actually were the A4s, the Skyhawks. Two of them came straight down the sound at us, and the ship was now turning and going at full power. And they came right up astern of us and passed straight over the ship. I mean, that at that point, it was obvious they were attacking us. I was standing on the flight there watching them coming down as we were the flight, because one of the things, our task was to be the eyes of the ship at the stern, because the ships don't have, lookouts as such are in certain areas. But the only people on the back of a ship is actually the flight. So we were told that we had to maintain a lookout and report if we saw anything. And in fact, we did have a couple of small arms. We had a GPMG, machine gun, and a couple of rifles on the flight as sort of, point defence, fire it and try and frighten somebody, probably frightening us more than everyone else. I remember standing by the door, and suddenly the flight commander shoved me into the fuel space. We had a refuelling space on the back of the ship, and shoved me out of the way. And we sort of end up with a big bundle in the thing. At that point, these two A4s and howling over the top of the ship, tremendous roaring and goodness knows what. And at that point, we sort of looked out at kind of what happened. As we looked out, the back of the ship was just enveloped in steam. We thought it was smoke at the time. In fact, what had happened, a 1,000-pound bomb had been launched at us, had gone through the loading door to the Sea Slug launcher, and we found out afterwards it had gone down, struck the like the roof of the Sea Slug lanes and come back up again, and actually hit the bottom underside of the flight deck. Because on the port side of the ship, just behind where Humphrey was, there's this big bulge on the flight deck, and it was actually hot from the stressing of the metal. And that's where the bomb had actually come up, hit it, and then dropped down and end up in the bathroom, which was just immediately below the flight deck. In the back end of the flight deck, we had a locker. It's a hatch in the deck, and in it was pyrotechnics. We kept Marco Marines and flares and things like that. Well, there was smoke pouring out. Well, I thought it was smoke. We thought it was smoke pouring out of it at the time. We thought it was on fire, and if this catches fire, it's phosphorus and all sorts down there. This could be nasty business, because we didn't actually know at this stage a bomb had come into the ship. We didn't know what it was. And various other damage reports were, we heard on the broadcast what was going on. Well, ship search was started for looking for damage. We rigged some fire, well, fire hoses are rigged anyway because we're at flying stations. We considered there may be a risk there was a fire somewhere. And one of the tasks is boundary cooling, where you actually cool, if there's a fire in a compartment, you cool the bulkhead with water, which stops fire spreading. So we commenced boundary cooling onto the back end of the ship and down the sides, assuming at that stage with no further information there was possibly fire, and therefore just try to contain it. Meanwhile, we were trying to get our pyro locker open. There was in the heat of the moment, we couldn't find the key for the padlock. So I dived into the hangar and grabbed the biggest chisel and hammer in the world. That's where I got my only war wound. When I hit me back of my hand, trying to knock the padlock off, I mean, I hit it so hard the second time, the whole hasp came straight out the deck and went over the side. We opened the locker, and in fact, it was just steam. In the back of the ship was a calorifier, which provides steam, hot water, to the bathrooms down below, and that the bomb had actually gone through and smashed it, and it was all steam. There were some, the flares and things like down below were damaged, but there was no fire, thank goodness. That's sort of like the first, and then it was reported there was a bomb. An exploded bomb was just below our feet, in the flight deck, in the bathrooms below the flight deck. The damage control departments within the ship wedged it to stop it rolling around. And then, meanwhile, other attacks were going on. There was air attacks all round, stuff popping off all over the place. And then a period later, and again, time eludes me. We were watching, and suddenly there was two more aircraft came round the headland, the entrance of the sound, and they were incredibly low on the water. And I was standing watching these two coming at us. Because some had come in previously and then veered away and gone for other ships, so you weren't always the target yourself. And this stage, it suddenly became apparent that we were game on again, it was us. And it was fascinating, it was unreal. It's calm sea, blue sea, the ship was going flat out and turning hard to evade. I remember this distinctly, it was turning to starboard. And these two aircraft closed up onto us, turned onto us and started to follow the ship on the turn. And as I watched them approaching, I was trying to identify them. And suddenly the water in front between the aircraft and the ship suddenly became alive with two lines. And I thought, what the hell's that? And I suddenly realised he'd opened up just with guns. He'd 30mm cannons on the bottom of the aircraft. And he was firing at us and tracking onto the ship with it. So as he was, if you can picture, as I was facing astern, the ship was turning to starboard. The aircraft were therefore banking to starboard to follow the ship round. And I was actually standing next to Terry at the time. And I said, I don't know if I did say anything. I remember, one thing I do clearly remember in my mind was I know those aircraft have guns mounted on the bottom of the aircraft. And they are banking to starboard. Therefore, the guns are moving away to the port side of the ship. Therefore, I'm going to the starboard side. And I just jumped round the corner of the superstructure of the ship just to put something between me and what was coming. And I was immediately joined by about half the flight, who had the same conclusion as myself. The flight commander and the flight observer, they dived into the fuel locker again. I'd already discounted that one, having been pushed in there once. I thought being among fuel wasn't probably the best place to be. One of the others, one of the other petty officers, he was the other electrician. Actually, in the time when we saw them, he got up between the aircraft and the ship's superstructure and all the way into the hangar. And I wouldn't have thought that was quite possible to do, but he did. I think Terry just stood and watched, to be honest. I just don't know what, whether he froze or was fascinated or just what. And suddenly there was just almighty roaring, and his aircraft went straight over the top in reheat. The afterburners going, tremendous noise. And I looked up, and as I saw it went over, they were actually climbed to get over the ship. They were so low. And as I looked up, I saw two white things sort of in the sky, and I suddenly realised they were two bombs coming down. They were parachute retard bombs. And as I looked up the starboard waist of the ship, I just saw these two bombs, and the ship was turning towards them. But in fact, they just missed. They missed the bow and fell in the sea. And at that point, I thought, phew, that one's passed. And at that point, I walked back onto the flight deck and suddenly realised the Sea Slug, which is this gigantic missile on the back of the ship, was glowing. There was two warshots on the launcher, and it fired. And normally you're not on the flight deck when these fire, because of the blast and the shockwave and everything else. I thought, what else are they going to do to us? And this missile went off. Luckily for us all on the flight deck, the missile was aimed off to starboard, so the jet efflux went over the ship's side. If it had been fired astern, it would have cleared the flight deck. Anyway, it fired after the aircraft, which were howling down the sound, and I actually watched the missile go and go straight down the sound after them. But in fact, I found after it wasn't actually on guidance. They'd fired it blind, just as a last-ditch attempt to do something. In fact, I believe the Antrim were awarded a kill. They think they hit one of the aircraft. In my mind, I'm not so convinced. I did watch those aircraft run down that sound and actually climb over the hill and disappear. That turn, I turned around the corner and walked onto the flight deck, and Terry was laying on the deck, laying on his back with his hands across his face, with blood running down the flight deck from him. And I went over to him, and he just said, Terry. And he just said to me, I've been hit. I was like, see that, you daft bugger, there's blood everywhere, you know. And I pulled his hands away, and his face was really not a pretty sight at all. Flight observer came then. And then we didn't know what else had happened, because at that time we then found that the aircraft had been stitched full of holes from the 30mm cannon shell. So had the ship. We had a hole in the bulkhead into a locker space, which we opened the door and there was smoke pouring out of there. And lots of debris and stuff all around the flight deck, and the aircraft was leaking fuel. We thought, we got a bit of a problem on our hands. So we have injured men, but we also have, the air crewman was also injured. He was hit by shrapnel. I then sort of got on with the aeroplane, really. The flight observer took over Terry. He said, leave him with me. And he got onto the phone and called for a doctor and said, this is serious, get the doctor to the flight deck now. And the doctor actually came up. We had a doctor on board, and he came to the flight deck. And he asked us to get a stretcher immediately, and at that point, I think we were under attack again. Although, in fact, it wasn't our ship, but they thought we were. And we got a stretcher for Terry, and he was ultimately taken away to the wardroom, which was the clearing station. And then we got on with the aeroplane. We initially washed the flight deck down with foam because we were a bit worried about fire. So we covered it with firefighting foam to start with. Then we had to make some assessments of the aeroplane and the situation we were now in. We dealt with what we thought was a fire in one of the locker rooms. In fact, it was a smoke from an explosive round going off, that was all. And then we suddenly realised how bad the ship was hit. There was holes all in the ship's side, across the flight deck, across the